the obesity epidemic and all of these diet-related non-communicable diseases, eating out of home is implicated. For most people, food is not nutritional. You know, for most people I've studied or I've worked with, it's not about health. Yes, that would be at the back of your mind, but it's culture that dictates what food is preferable, how people eat, what goes onto the plates. It's really just culture, as you know.
Hello and welcome to the Experts in Health podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast aims to highlight the latest research and trends in health, as we welcome a variety of guests from a host of different disciplines. I'm Dr. Chris McLeod, an academic in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences with an expertise in behavioural nutrition and public health. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Hiba Osei-Kwasi, a public health nutrition academic at Loughborough University. Hiba, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Chris. And just so you know, you got my name really right. Right. Well done.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. And before we sort of get going into what we're going to talk about, we've just had a brief chat about the jacket that you're wearing, and I asked a couple of questions, and you said that there was a little bit special behind the jacket.
So yeah.
Can you help our listeners to, if they're not seeing you?
Okay,
right now?
So it's not just this particular jacket, but with African prints. So whenever I have an event like this one, this special podcast or conferences, I tend to put on African jackets. That is because I still have really strong social ties, family ties in Africa, and it's my own way of staying connected with Ghana, you know, so like representing my country here. Loughborough is about diversity, isn't it? Mm. And so if I always wear the usual clothing everyone wears, then I don't see the diversity. So it's my own way of showcasing my country here in a very, should I say, white population?
Yeah, yes, I mean, yes, statistically,
yes,
you can say
yes,
that.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it's fab to see and to hear the added layer. It's not just clothes. It's got that added cultural element to it as well. And I guess that is really nice link to what we're going to be talking about today, you know, the cultural aspects in relation to food. Before we get into that, though, can you just tell our listeners and viewers a little bit more about yourself?
Right. So you mentioned my name, right? But I could repeat that. So my name is Dr. Hiba Araba Osei-Kwasi. I like to put in the Araba again just to show where I come from. So Araba is a name from a Fanti tribe in Ghana. Mm. So it tells people from Ghana where I come from in Ghana. So I always put it that when I'm introducing myself. Now, I started my career and education in Ghana. I did my bachelor's in community nutrition. Worked for about 4 to 5 years as a research assistant in a research institution called the Noguchi Memorial Institute for Medical Research. Then I traveled to Europe to do my master's, so master's in nutrition and rural development in Belgium. It was a 2-year master's. Went back to Ghana to work for a bit, and then I came to the UK to do a PhD in public health nutrition, and then I have remained in the UK ever since then.
And then since that point, you stayed in the UK, as you say.
Yes.
What did you do from then on?
Okay. So my PhD focused on nutrition of ethnic minority groups. So that is actually what started my interest in nutrition of ethnic minority groups. So after my PhD, I had a fellowship that allowed me to even go into further understanding nutrition and eating behaviors among ethnic minority groups. Before the fellowship, I forgot this one. Yes, I worked with a multidisciplinary team on some global nutrition issues. So usually my research is in two folds, the ethnic minority part, but also global nutrition issues. The global nutrition issues that I've worked on includes, you know, looking at the food environment. So the team I worked with actually developed the what we call the African Food Environment Framework. You know, so this was informed by the research we did in Ghana and Kenya. And I did all of that after my PhD. But then what I'm really very much interested in, beyond the global nutrition issues, is understanding eating behaviors of ethnic minorities, particularly people of African and Caribbean origin. So that's what I've done up until now. That's what I'm working on. That's what I'm looking to work on in the future as well.
Sounds really interesting. And to help our listeners, you know, further delve into this topic, can you give a little bit of a, you know, an opening statement to say why what we're going to talk about today, the eating behaviours of ethnic minorities, those particular minorities you mentioned, why is that so important to you and why should our listeners and viewers be interested about that?
Because eating behaviours amongst ethnic minority population is really complex, and I'm trying to counter what we call the deficit approach.
What is that for our
listeners? That's what we'll be talking about, yeah. You know. But before I get to that, yeah. I want to explain why I tend to focus on this population in particular. Now, we do know that health inequalities, you know, that is experienced by ethnic minorities in general, I mean, this is in the literature, is partly influenced by, you know, eating behaviors, the differences in dietary behaviors. But we don't have enough data or evidence for the diets or dietary practices of this population. You know, very few people are researching in this area. A lot of mainstream researchers would say this population, well, or these populations are hard to reach groups. And that is why coming from that population, first of all, that's why that's really interesting for me, because I come from this group and I really want to be able to do something having come from that population myself, right? That's number one. Number two, ethnic minority populations are really a very diverse group. I guess that's why it makes studying them really complex. So the main groups would be the South Asians, you know, African and Caribbean groups. We also have the Chinese. But even within the African and Caribbean origin groups, Chris, there are so many differences. There are so many different groups. Mm. So I tend to focus on the African immigrants, you know, so those from Sub-Sahara Africa. My research has focused on Ghanaians, you know, West African immigrants in the UK. We have evidence, even though very little, to show that they tend to have higher prevalence of, you know, obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension. There was a study that was conducted, a huge study, known as the RODAM study. So RODAM stands for Research on Diabetes and Obesity Among African Immigrants. They compared Ghanaians in different European cities, so London, Amsterdam, Berlin, and then Ghanaians in Ghana. And then they realized that they had higher prevalence of all of these nutrition-related diseases, you know, so that goes to show that migration is doing something to the health of these people. The food environment, you know, there's something, because these are the same people, same Ghanaians that are being compared, you know, in different cities. They realized that the people, especially people who lived in the UK, London, for instance, had a higher prevalence of obesity as compared to others in the other Ghanaians in other cities. You know, so there's a lot of reasons why this is of interest to me, apart from being one myself. But yeah. The health, the evidence on health shows that we need to understand the issues.
And even though you said that within those minority groups, there's such great difference between, you know, in smaller groups as well, yeah. You're seeing that there are these trends at the wider level for that particular population. You know, the particular immigrant population group, it is prevalent at the higher level as well as the smaller level as well between other groups within that population. Do you know that?
Do you mean within the Ghanaian group?
Yeah, specifically. So at the higher level being Ghanaian group,
yeah.
And then even more smaller groups within
yes.
that.
Oh, yes, because I did a number of qualitative studies among Ghanaians in Greater Manchester. And yes, even within the Ghanaians in Greater Manchester, you would realize that they don't really all have the same dietary behaviors. And that's why I said it's interesting and important to focus on these groups, because they're complex. You know, yeah. Their eating behaviors are complex. There's so many things we really still don't understand. There are differences. And so we need to really get to the bottom of why we have these differences to be able to design really effective interventions. Yeah, they are not a homogenous group, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's helpful. So talk to us a little bit more about dietary behaviours, their eating behaviours. What do you observe within this, these particular communities in regard to eating and dietary behaviours?
Right, so my research, which started off from my PhD, showed that generally most people maintained their traditional diets upon migrating to the UK. You know, it didn't really matter how many years they had lived here, you know, it could be 30 years or more, you know, they would still eat their Ghanaian food. So the jollof rice, the fufu, you know, and I think this has also been reported among other ethnic minority groups. Mm-hmm. Now, within the Ghanaian group, yes, there were some differences. So the second generation would have mixed diets. So they would have a bit of the Ghanaian foods. They would also have what we term the Western foods. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so for me, what is important is, you know, when we talk about the obesity epidemic and all of these diet-related non-communicable diseases, eating out of home is implicated. You know, so unhealthy eating, eating high energy, high fat foods, fast foods, is what is often implicated in, you know, unhealthy eating practices and the obesity epidemic. But then this is not what my research has shown for this population group, because they tend to cook and eat their own foods. Mm. But are we not encouraging people to cook and eat homemade foods? That's what we are encouraging people to do in the bid to try and address or cut down the intake of fast foods, you know. So that's why we cannot have a blanket approach to addressing unhealthy eating. Because these people don't often eat, of course, every now and then people will eat out of home, but they tend to cook and eat their foods.
And so, yeah, that's really interesting because that those traditional behaviours then, you're saying, are replicated whether they're living in the UK or living where they were previously.
Yes.
But there's a difference in their obesity prevalence and, and health markers. So why is that? What's happening? What do you know at the moment?
There's a lot being done. If I say I know, Chris, I think that's what lots of researchers are trying to understand, and that's why they always do these comparative studies. I mean, there are a lot of hypotheses.
What would you hypothesize? Or like, if you were to think, like, why might this happen?
So for people in the UK, which is what I tried to understand when I did my studies in Manchester, it is still the traditional foods, but then a few unhealthy habits have been identified, and this was reported by participants themselves. You know, so people are consuming more, so portion sizes have increased, you know, because some of my participants have told me that food is relatively cheaper here, depending on where you come from before you migrated. So people have more accessibility to, you know, animal protein. So people are having more meat, more fish, you know, people are having a bit more sugar sweetened drinks, you know. So yes, the diet hasn't changed, but people are probably eating a lot more. Back in Ghana, back in Africa, most people would, and again, this is from the studies that I've done, do more physical activity, not consciously, you know, people would walk and take the bus and public transport. But here, it's not the same, you know, people are kind of, there's more sedentary behaviours, I guess.
Which would change the energy balance.
Exactly.
The energy in versus energy out, if you think about it simplistically.
I think that's what I can remember from the research I did a couple of years ago, So these are other reasons,
I wonder whether there's another thing, maybe for a future exploration, but I wonder what the role is for the out-of-home meals or these, you know, drinks that wouldn't have been available or present in sort of the diets of people when they're before they migrated. Because we see in sort of small change approaches to changing our diet, there's a body of literature out there saying a small change approach can be helpful. If you cut out the biscuit in your day, or you change the drinks that you're having, so you can save a few hundred calories a day, that overall might have an effect. I wonder if the opposite way around is true, that it's actually just these one-off, once-a-week meals out, which are actually quite significantly more in energy that it contains. You know, it's just 400 calories more than they would do if they were cooking at home, but that over some weeks, there's no compensation for that extra 400 calories, and so over a month, you see that someone's consumed 3,000 calories more, let's say, than they might have done if they were eating their sort of more traditional diet.
So I wonder, Chris, if that's the case. The emerging evidence shows that the food environment in Ghana, and I'll keep referring to Ghana because a lot of my work has been in Ghana, is really becoming very much like what we see here. So yes, a lot of the participants I have worked with, at the time they were migrating, we didn't have the KFCs, we didn't have all of that in Ghana. You go to Ghana today and there's a lot of those, you know, so it's really becoming very similar. People are getting easy access to all of these foods that used not to be, you know, in Ghana some years back, 10, 20 years ago. So I still think that it is, and that's why I said it's a complex issue. It's beyond just what people are eating, you know. African immigrants that I speak to would tell you lots of people have to do night shifts, you know, and we do know that, you know, when you do night shifts, sometimes you have problems with sleeping properly. There's been studies that have shown links between poor sleep and obesity, stress. A lot of immigrants complain about stress, psychosocial stress. Some people complain about discrimination. All of these have been associated with these poor health outcomes. You know, so the complexity is because of these other issues, you know, the structural barriers that some immigrants, you know, face.
Can you just explain a bit more what you mean by that, the structural barriers, the psychosocial difficulties?
So studies have shown that immigrants, people of African origin, African and Caribbean origin, tend to be of lower socioeconomic status, you know, as compared to the mainstream population. So which means that they would live in areas, you know, food deserts, areas where they wouldn't have access to healthy foods. They would engage in jobs, you know, occupation that wouldn't really pay well. These have a huge impact on their health. These have so even when they are eating or preparing their own foods, sometimes they might go for cheaper or unhealthy versions, unhealthy cuts of meats, you know. And all of that, you know, eventually impacts on their health. Yes, so they might be eating their own foods, but, you know, what kinds of vegetables are being used, what kinds of meat is being used, what kind of oil is being used, you know. So, yes, that's what I mean by the structural barriers, the inequalities we have in society today eventually impacts on what people eat.
Okay, and could you give us a flavour of Ghanaian food? What is Ghanaian food like? What are typical foods that people might have during the day? And what's the sort of nutritional profile of that? Is it quite a healthy diet in general?
Do you want my view or view of my participants personally?
I would love both.
Yes. Yes, Ghanaian foods are healthy, can be very healthy, just like other foods. Typical examples, and I'm sure Chris, you would have heard, you know, jollof rice. So it's mainly very carbohydrate dense, and that's why I said it can be healthy depending on how it's prepared, depending on how it's served. Now, let me speak from the point of view of my participants, because I did this study. My whole fellowship focused on cooking. I wanted to understand what was going on in Ghanaian homes, because prior research had shown that most people perceive the Ghanaian meals or Ghanaian foods as healthy. So I wanted to really go and understand how it's been prepared. Unfortunately, because of COVID, I couldn't go into people's homes to observe. But then I used a qualitative methodology known as photo voice to get people to take photos, you know, and be able to use those photos to explain their cooking process and tell us their perceptions about Ghanaian meals. So I'm going to tell you about some of them. So, yes, a lot of the times it's always a staple. So the staple could be rice. Most of the times, it could also be yam. I don't know if you know yam.
Like a sweet potato, sort of. Is
yes,
it similar?
Except it's not sweet. You know, so it's yam, plantain, or prepared into what we call fufu. You know, that's usually the base. And then you have a vegetable soup or a vegetable sauce that would have meat, fish, you know, anything that can, eggs, all of those animal proteins. It tends to always have animal proteins, some vegetables, and then the carbohydrate base. Mm-hmm. Now, the research we have done so far shows that it is what goes onto the plate. You know, so what I've described is just what we tell people to eat. Yeah. Have your starchy carbs, mm-hmm. have your proteins, animal or plant proteins, you know, and have healthy fat. But it is what goes onto the plate. Now, we have observed that, or I know from being a part of the community, that a lot of the times our plates tend to be a lot of the staple. Mm-hmm. So 3/4 of the plates tends to be filled with the rice mm-hmm. or the fufu, you know, and then the vegetable sauce tends to be very little, mm-hmm. and then a bit of the animal protein on the side. Mm-hmm. So when people move here and then they become a bit well off, mm-hmm. then the animal protein would increase. But the starchy carbohydrate doesn't reduce, mm-hmm. which is one of the things I observed through the studies I've done so far.
So they get more on their plate, not, there's no more, displacement.
They get more, right. They have more animal proteins, meat, fish, you know, eggs, whatever, mm-hmm. but then the starch doesn't reduce.
Okay, interesting. And do we see that across different populations, whether that's typical UK populations or other minority groups that you've been looking at?
So, my observation is that it might not be the same with the UK population. I mean, yeah, just from going out for dinner with colleagues, you know, no, it's not the same. Mm. We have this joke that if you go for an event and you want to know that it's a Ghanaian event, you know, the vegetables are always untouched. There are people who tell you, no, I don't like salads. I don't like, you know, the vegetables would always be there. The meat would go, the fish would go, yeah. rice, everything would go away. The vegetables is untouched. I don't tend to see that very much. You know, when I go out with other population groups, yeah, people tend to have their vegetables. I might be wrong. This is
I know that many of our populations in the UK, which includes a broad different demographics of the UK, but don't eat enough fruit and veg for optimization. But I don't know how that relatively compares. You know, one group could be having one portion of fruit and veg a day and the other half or none or something like that.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at that too. But I think the issue with the population that I have focused on is it's just the fact that the starchy carbs are just too much, are consumed in excess. Mm. That's my observation. That's what participants even say. They know. Mm. People know that, you know, we tend to consume a lot of starchy carbs. It's not just an observation. Participants talk about it, which is what the deficit approach I mentioned
initially. Yes, tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah. So informed by my previous research, you know, the PhD, a bit of the postdoc, I realized that the issue wasn't that people don't know what healthy eating is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you speak to Ghanaians, you know, in the UK, if you speak to other African immigrants, everyone knows what a healthy diet is, which I assume might be the case across a lot of population, you know. So I went on to do this in the fellowship to try and challenge that assumption that people lack the understanding of how to eat healthy, or, you know. And that's what I did in the fellowship. And that's what my study really showed. Part of that study was featured recently in The Conversation, you know. So Ghanaian women know what healthy eating is. They understand what it means to cook healthy. They know the differences between healthy oils and unhealthy oils and saturated fats and all of that, you know. So why are some people not still doing the right thing? Has nothing to do with knowledge or not understanding the issues. Mm. Now, I checked the literature and I know that in the UK and other high-income countries, the evidence shows that cooking skills or cooking has declined. You know, that's not the case with this group. And we studied Ghanaians in Manchester as well as Ghanaians in Ghana, and we realized that people still cook. Mm. You know, so the issue is not just educating people to cook more. Mm. It is more complex than that.
Yes.
And that's what I meant by the deficit approach, because that tends to assume that, you know, people lack the knowledge or the skills. Mm-hmm. You know, and you see that in a lot of healthy eating discussions and political discussions. Mm-hmm. You know, where people don't have the knowledge to do the right thing.
Yeah.
That's not the issue with the population I'm studying. Okay. No, they do know a lot. There might be a few people who still need a bit of education, but a lot of people know right from wrong. They know.
So then, if it's not about educating about what a healthy diet is, but there's still a high prevalence of obesity and the associated difficulties that that brings, and it's associated, so you say, also with food in some regards,
yes,
how much or what types of food. So if it's not skills and it's not an education about what a healthy diet is, why are the populations that you're studying not engaging in changing their behaviours to have a healthier diet? Do you have any idea?
Chris, that's a very difficult question for me to answer.
Fair enough. That's the end of the podcast. Thank you.
No, but yes, that's what I'm spending, I guess, the next phase of my research, you know, to try and answer.
Yeah.
So the first part of the first 10 years of my life in the UK has focused on understanding the issues, determinants of dietary behaviors, understanding the practices. So I know, which I've just summarized to you, I know what the practices are. I know the determinants of those practices. So for the next phase of my research, I want to be able to look for solutions, you know, and I have some ideas, which I'm going to talk about. Yeah. But the rest, we still have to do the research to be able to address it. Now, what are some of my ideas? My key message is that food to most people is cultural. That I know. We all know that. But beyond that, we tend to think that people think about health and nutrition. For most people, food is not nutritional. Mm-hmm. You know, for most people I've studied or I've worked with, it's not about health. Yes, that would be at the back of your mind, but it's culture that dictates what food is preferable, how people eat, what goes onto the plate. It's really just culture, as you know. Current interventions have focused on individual level determinants, which is
what
why I said, so that current interventions have focused on knowledge, attitude, practices, which is important. But it's not enough, particularly for this group, which is why I said in my postdoc, which was funded by AXA, I set out to challenge that deficit approach, which tends to assume that people lack the knowledge and the understanding and the understanding to do the right thing. That's not the case. Mm. So we need to go beyond the individual level determinants, particularly for this population groups. And yes, I don't know what the answer is, but we have to work together with the community. Mm. Co-produce interventions. I know there's a lot of talk about co-production, but we still don't really know how an effective intervention looks like.
Mm. So, to engage in an effective co-production, and for those listening, co-production is when academics or policymakers work with the target population to create the intervention to improve their health.
Yeah.
Is there a particular person, type of person, that's best to engage with the community? So is it better that you, as someone from that culture, helps to engage in that co-production, or does it not matter at all?
It does matter a lot. Mm-hmm. We did a community intervention, so just before I joined Loughborough, we had a a small intervention together with the Caribbean and Health Network in Manchester, just tried something to help people eat healthier, really small scale. And then when we did a process evaluation, one of the factors that came out was the fact that it was led by people from the community. You know, it was more acceptable because participants thought that we understood, you know, we understood the food, they trusted, because all of us were, Khan is black-led, but then the people who delivered the intervention, myself and my other colleagues, we have a small, we're a small network of nutrition academics who call ourselves Sahara Nutrition, you know, so the trust was there. So it's not just the trust, it's just the fact that people thought we kind of understood the culture, you know, we knew what we were talking about in terms of the food and the food culture, you know. So if I was making recommendations, certain foods are eaten in a certain way. And I'll give you an example. You might not know what kenke is. Kenke is one of our very popular traditional staple. It's traditionally eaten with fish, fried fish, and very little pepper sauce. So kenke could be, you know, the size of my fist. You could have one fish that is the size of my palm, but the pepper sauce, which is just grounded pepper, tomatoes and onion, could just be 1 teaspoon or 1 tablespoon. That's how it's eaten. A few people would have cut onions or cut tomatoes, very little on the side, you know. But in that intervention, we tried to get people to understand it doesn't have to be eaten that way. Mm-hmm. You can have a bit more vegetables. Mm-hmm. So we shared our own plates, you know, so I'll cut a bit more of vegetables, add cucumber, which is traditionally not eaten that way. And then just by doing that, people were like, okay, if Hiba, who is Ghanaian and eats kenke, can have a kenke with cut cucumber, then maybe I should also try it. And that's what participants said, you know, they just decided to try it to see. You know, there were people who said, and we're always meeting them on Zoom, that, you know, if you eat kenke that way, our ancestors will be upset with you. That's not how it's eaten traditionally. Right. You know, why are you destroying the culture?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to do with the research I'm doing and the colleagues I'm working with is finding a balance between culture and health. Mm-hmm. Respecting those customs and traditions and the way we eat, but finding ways around it so there's a balance between, just like that example I gave, you know, how do we introduce some more vegetables into a meal that is traditionally eaten with very little onions and tomatoes? What else can we add to it so people, it's acceptable, it's socially desirable, and we don't want it to be us proposing, as researchers, as nutrition professionals, telling people what to do. You know, so we want to do it together. We could discuss it, but this is not complete. You know, you're supposed to have 5 a day. You know, so where can we introduce some more vegetables?
Yeah.
Chris, it's what I've been doing.
I'll leave you to answer that over the next few years, mate.
Yes.
But I think we like to ask the tough questions when we can on this podcast. And I just think one interesting thing, you said there that you were able to create a small scale intervention where you had Zoom calls with a group of people,
yeah,
and you could show them how the foods could change,
yeah,
so that they could see what that looks like in reality. And from what I've seen, you saw that actually people did change,
did. What,
and that had some beneficial effects for,
yes,
them.
Yes.
What levers do you have, though, to roll that out across the different groups of we see of these ethnic minorities? They're not just in one place in the UK, they're spread out across the UK. And there's only one Hiba, and Hiba to do all of these different things in different places, you have a full-time job doing that,
yeah,
and you've,
yeah,
got another full-time job at the moment. So, you know, how, what are the levers that you have got that you're, you know, that you've got available to you to actually deliver such an intervention at a scale?
So, Chris, that's my dilemma, but I'm not worried about it because that's what I want to do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people who have done, you know, successful interventions. So there's a professor called Louis Goff who does a lot of lifestyle interventions within the African and Caribbean communities. You know, I've been in touch with her recently. She knows about this study because I presented it at a recent diabetes conference in London. For me, the next step is to do that study, bearing in mind how it's going to be, how we're going to scale it up, how we're going to, you know, sustainability of such interventions. And I applied for FIND, a public health intervention development grant last year. I wasn't successful. We might do it again this year. So we are in the process of developing an intervention study. And whilst developing that, we need to think through all of this, because as you said, that is not scalable, what we did. You know, it took a lot of our time. It was a one-time thing, and we haven't gone back. So this is what my next research is going to focus on. Yes, on a small scale, we did see, you know, the impact it had on people. We have a lot of testimonials, but yeah. That's we need to do it well and bear, you know, think about how we can scale it up. So that's what my next research is going to focus on.
Sounds like a good lot of research that you've got to do there.
A lot of work.
Because also I know that as part of Loughborough University, you're the special envoy to Africa.
Yes.
For the whole, for the university.
Yes,
that's
together
correct, isn't
with
it?
My colleague Dr. Shola of Folabi. Yes, so there are two of us.
It's quite a big role, and
it is.
You're also doing work in Ghana with the Centre for Lifestyle Medicine and Behaviour as well.
Yes.
So what is that extra work, you know, what are you doing in those different domains?
So the envoy role, which I really love, because like I told you, on a personal level, I still have a lot of social ties in Africa. Just means you are an ambassador for the university, you know, so trying to build, lead in, you know, collaborations for research collaborations, partnerships for the university. And before I had the envoy role, Chris, I was already working with colleagues overseas in Africa. So it really isn't outside of what I do, because as I told you at the beginning, I kind of wear two hats. Apart from focusing on ethnic minorities in the UK, I'm also interested in research, you know, global nutrition, but nutrition specifically for sub-Sahara Africa. So doing the envoy role just facilitates this. This year we have the Climb Ghana meeting, I think at the end of May. We also have envoy related activities. The VC might be traveling to Ghana and Nigeria. So, you know, it's just going to coincide with the Climb meeting. And I think that just works really well, just showcases the collaborations we are having. You know, so Loughborough is not just focusing on promoting health in the UK, but it's doing that, you know, across the world. And envoy role just, I think, facilitates this for me.
Amazing. Yeah. A lot of great impact that you're having and will continue to have. And where can our listeners and viewers find out more about you and what you are doing?
Social media, so Twitter, I think, yeah, I try to tweet quite a bit when we are doing events, you know, and then LinkedIn, I guess, yeah. I think the last thing I didn't mention, it's the work that I do with the community, Chris. So outside of my everyday academic work, teaching, research, I tend to do a lot of community engagement work. And for me, that was more like a way to give back to the community, because my PhD was all around talking to people, you know, black people in Manchester and across the UK. And so once or twice every week, I host and facilitate a nutrition discussion with people, lifestyle discussion. In fact, now I'm even going beyond nutrition. So there's a black-led organization that has asked me to help them host what we call a lifestyle nugget. So, you know, just once a week, we would meet on Zoom in the evenings and have a chat. We're starting with setting financial goals. So this is not nutrition, it's not lifestyle, it's not my research, but these are issues that are important for us as a community. I always say us, because I see myself as one. I'm an African immigrant. And I think these are important issues that we need to look at holistically. So yes, I'm a nutrition, public health nutrition academic, but I do all of these things with the community on the side, because I think overall, it's not just about what you eat. It's also if you are financially sound. It's also about if you have the right social network and connections, you know. So yeah, I'm also really busy outside of the university doing these things, and I'm really passionate about the community work as well. So
if you were then going to, this is a standard outro we like to ask our guests, but if you were to be talking to someone who is younger in your community outreach group, and you were going to sell your area of expertise, your interest, to that next generation of curious minds as an inspiration piece, because you are an inspiration to many people, what would you say?
About myself?
Let's go with your area to put you less on the spot of yourself. About the area that you're interested in, why should other people, younger generations, be interested and get into the area that you're interested in?
Got you now. Because really, food is medicine, you know, and especially for people, young people within the community that I work with, I think they would grow up to understand that just by virtue of us being black, we have a higher risk genetically to getting obese, you know, a lot of these lifestyle related diseases. So what can we do? This area that I'm focusing on would help us to prevent these diseases, you know. Just by being black, by being African or Caribbean origin, you are at a higher risk of getting obesity, of being getting diabetes, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, you name it. So we need a lot more people in public health nutrition, because we'll provide the evidence, we'll support people within our community to prevent the disease in the first place. And that's the only way we can reduce the high prevalence of these diseases. That's the only way we can cut down on these problems within our community. So, yeah, we could make the generational change. Hopefully the next generation, we would have less of these statistics. I don't like it, and I don't think younger people within my community like to hear the fact that, oh, people of African origin tend to have the highest prevalence of obesity. It is not nice to hear, Chris. Yes, so this is one of the ways we can address the problem, preventing it in the first place.
Well, you're inspiring that next generation.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great to talk with you today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. And thank you very much for tuning in. If you've liked what we've talked about today, feel free to like or subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. And you can also check out our other podcast, Experts in Sport, as well. You can find the link to that in the show notes. So that just leaves me to say thank you once again for tuning in. And I look forward to welcoming you back to another health-related chat in a future episode. Bye-bye for now.